Hi, this is Marlena Lieberg welcoming you to Blind Spot. Blind Spot is a series of programs heard this time each week on ACB Radio where we talk no-tech, low-tech kinds of things. If you've got an idea for something you'd like to hear on Blind Spot, why not drop me an email? My email address is Marlena, that's M-A-R-L-A-I-N-A, at acbradio.org. Hello, and welcome to Blind Spot. I'm Marlena Lieberg, and I'll be with you for the next hour. If you are listening live, I really encourage you to call in, and let me give the call-in number right now, because I expect the lines to get busy quickly. The call-in number is area code 212-812-2800, and the PIN is 0480-5512. And with my somewhat hoarse voice today, after having gone to a Mariners game yesterday and screamed my head off until we lost in the bottom of the ninth, oh dear, I would like to introduce you to my guest this evening. This is a very special Blind Spot for me, and I think for many of you, based on your email responses to this person. We're going to be meeting tonight Eric Weinmayer, who was the first blind person ever to climb Mount Everest and reach the top. And I've been reading Eric's book, To Touch the Top of the World, and I'm going to ask him to talk about that as well. But I've had the happy opportunity to get some insights into this very cool guy based on what I read in this very cool book that I'm almost finished with it. Eric, welcome to Blind Spot.
Thank you.
It's so nice to have you here. And one of the things that jumps out at me right away from reading your book is from the time you were a little kid, you really had quite a spirit of adventure.
Yeah, I wanted to live an exciting life, and I was kind of almost blinded by the fact that I wanted to be a part of the group. I wanted to be in the thick of things. I wanted to be definite, you know, part of the world. I didn't want to be swept to the sidelines. And so I went blind when I was 13 and never really lost that sense. I was probably a little too reckless for a while because I was just looking for ways so hard to be a part of the, you know, regular guy. Took me a while to be able to figure out those systems and accept blindness, you know, not really try to, like, fight it, but just to accept it. So that was a couple years of transition for sure.
One of the other things that jumps out at me in the book is that you had fabulous family support. And it was kind of interesting because your dad seemed, on the one hand, to be more, let's let him go out and do it, and if he skins his knees when he falls off his bike, you know, so be it. And your mom seemed to be more, I want him to do things, but I don't want him to get hurt.
Yeah, it was pretty typical, you know. My mom was like a... my dad and mom, I compare them to like a broom in a dustpan, you know, it'd sweep me out, I'd shatter into a million pieces, and my mom would sweep me back up again and put me together.
Yeah.
But yeah, my dad was always trying to find ways for me to be able to do stuff. You know, there was some crazy stuff that I did, like I used to ride a motorcycle, but I could barely see, you know, so I really shouldn't have been on the road, and they put a nix on that. But a lot of things they really tried to kind of let me do, but figure out a special way to do it, you know, like I'd jump my bike over this little ramp at the bottom of my driveway.
Yes, would you tell that story?
Yeah. I set up these wooden ramps in my cul-de-sac, you know. I'd go off one ramp and I'd fly through the air maybe 10 or 12 feet and land on another wooden ramp. And there was a point when I was going blind when I couldn't see that ramp anymore. And, you know, my dad was, instead of just saying you can't do it, he went out and he painted it real bright orange with the spray paint, and so I could see it for another 6 months or so. But they're always trying to be creative like that, figuring out ways of doing stuff. And that's really carried over in my life because, you know, there are a lot of systems for blindness like Braille and cane travel and computers, but there are some things you kind of have to discover on your own. And that kind of creative attitude's helped me discover a lot of things on my own, especially how to be safe and efficient, and, you know, in the outdoors.
One of the most amazing things to me that I have read thus far in the book. And I know I'm kind of jumping all over the place here, but I really want to make sure we talk about this because it kind of tags on to what you just said about being creative and knowing how important safety is. I was so, I guess, taken is the best word I can use by the story, the chapter in the book where you talked about when you had the first time you had to set up a tent on the mountain, and somebody said, "Well, let me do it for you," and you said, "No." And would you tell that story, and then
sure.
how you figured out how to deal with the issues that needing to use your hands presented?
Yeah, well, we wanted to. We were doing all these training climbs, getting ready for Mount McKinley. And I had worked on setting up tents, but, you know, all tents are different. And so we were on this training climb in March in Mount Rainier, and we were about at, you know, 7,000 feet on something called the Muir Snowfield. It's a big flat section, and it's really windy there, especially as it gets dark. It starts to get super windy in the afternoon, and it was snowing, and not just like a regular fluffy snow, but like these little needle pinpricks of ice that were just coming down. And so I was, everybody was working hard. We were setting up snow walls and everything.
Could you explain what a snow wall is?
A snow wall is just like where you go in, you saw, take a snow saw, and you saw out blocks out of the ice, and you lay them on a wall. You're making a brick wall, basically, but with snow blocks. So you got to do that to break the wind, and then you put your tent in the middle, and you have a little door and everything, and it's really a cool thing. But I was assigned to setting up the tents, and I found that with big, thick mountaineering gloves on, I couldn't orient the tent in front of me. I couldn't find how to put the poles into the little sleeves and loops and everything. I couldn't find the corners. So every time, you know, I'd take my gloves off and I'd try to put the tent together. And every time I do that, these little shards of ice and snow would just wail against my hands and they'd go numb. So my hands were like these cold, dead fish at the end of my wrists. And I'd put my gloves back on and beat them out again. And anyway, I was so slow doing this that couple teammates had finished their job and came over and set the tent up for me, and I was just I was totally devastated because I wanted to be an independent person, as independent as I could be in the mountains. I didn't want to just sort of be the blind guy that got dragged up the mountain and spiked on top like a football, you know. I wanted to be a part of the team. I wanted people to respect me. I wanted to climb with dignity. I didn't want to do things differently when I didn't have to. Now I'd realize that certain things, you know, my team has to accommodate me in terms of, like, you know, they give me directions. Sometimes if there's something real specific, they'll take their ski pole and tap it where they want me to step. You know, a lot of verbal communication. Not a tremendous amount, but there are things that I should have been able to do, and I wanted to be able to do those things well. I didn't want to have people do stuff for me when they didn't have to. So I was super annoyed with myself, and I went back to Phoenix where I lived at the time, and I went to this field near the school. I was a teacher at the time. And I, you know, it's like 105 degrees in Phoenix, and I had a mountaineering gloves on and a tank top and 105 degrees in this field and sat there working on breaking the tent up, down, and setting it up and breaking it down with those mountaineering gloves on. And about 3 months later, when Mount McKinley came along, I could set up tents in any condition. I could set up tents in a whiteout, which sighted people can't. So it was, you know, a lot of those things I've learned have been through flopping on my face the first time. And that's just the way it is, you know. I mean, unless you're a genius, you know, some geniuses, I guess, can just never make a mistake and just be creative from the start. For me, it takes a good knock in the head before I realize, hey, wake up and learn to do the things you can do as well as you can and let go of the things that you can't do. But be careful, because there's a very blurry line between the things we can do and the things we can't. You know, you got to sometimes figure out a way to cross through that line.
Yeah, and kind of know for sure, is it that I can't do it or that I don't know how to do it, that I haven't figured it out yet?
Exactly, yeah, there's a few things that you can't do. You know, a blind person can't yet drive a car. I don't know any good way to do it yet, but even though maybe after a few beers I've tried. But,
you and me both.
Yeah. But it's not, you know, it's probably not practical. You know, you're probably not going to catch a baseball or be a good baseball player, but there's so many things that, you know, it's just a blurry line, and it's kind of exciting and torturous at the same time, I think, to figure out how to cross through that line. And that, I'd say almost like, I don't know, 50%, maybe even more of the time, there's ways of doing something if you really totally sit there and think about it and have the courage to try and flop on your face a bunch of times.
The telephone number is area code 212-812-2800, and the PIN is 0480-5512. And my guest tonight is Eric Weinmeier. No, sorry, Weinmeier. I'll get it right. Stop me if I get it wrong. This is a very informal show, Eric.
No problem.
And Eric, of course, is the first blind person ever to have climbed Mount Everest. What the heck made you want to start climbing mountains?
Well, I was an athlete from the, you know, even when I could see pretty well, and I used to love riding bikes, and I did play basketball a lot. And I went blind, and I realized the future is not in basketball. You know, I'm not going to be very good at this sport. I was looking for stuff that I could do, and I always sort of never lost a sense of adventure. You know, people, most blind people know that obviously when you go blind, nothing really changes in your life. You just, now you can't see. So I retained all the things I had as a sighted kid, and I wanted to figure out a sport I could do, so I tried a bunch of different things. I went tandem biking like that, and I cross-country skied a little bit, but did all these things in a kind of a recreational program for blind kids that was run through the Carroll Center for the Blind, and one weekend they took us rock climbing, and I thought that was awesome. I mean, I thought it was perfect. There's no ball to catch. You were sort of connecting with nature. You were. It was like wrestling, because I had wrestled for a couple of years when I started rock climbing. It was very intuitive. You know, you could leverage. It was all about leveraging your body and all about angles and positions. I mean, you could totally feel it through your body, and you could connect with the rock. And I could, you know, feel hands and feet like a sighted person would use their eyes and scan my way up there. And, you know, I might have to hang a little bit longer as I'm scanning one hand and hanging by the other. But, you know, it seemed to work, and it seemed to be pretty darn fun. So it was a good lesson, because, you know, blindness was definitely an annoying factor and something I had to work around. But it didn't have to kind of, you know, stop me in my tracks. It just had to be a nuisance or something that you had to work your way around, you know.
Yeah. And so it all started when you started rock climbing?
Yeah, exactly. I loved rock climbing and started rock climbing, you know, just like a couple times a year, because I was in, you know, Connecticut. There wasn't real access to a lot of rocks.
Yeah, not in Connecticut.
But then after college, I moved out to Arizona so I could really start rock climbing. There's, you know, Arizona's just like a big rock in the desert. Climbed every kind of rock I could find, you know, granite and basalt and sandstone and limestone and rhyolite, which is like volcanic sharp rock, and got pretty good at rock climbing. And and then a friend of mine said, hey, let's climb some bigger mountains. What, like, I'd been climbing like 100-foot rock faces in the desert, and I thought, you mean like a 200-foot rock face? And he said, no, how about Mount McKinley? It's like 20,300-foot glaciated mountain. You know, it's like the coldest place in the world in Alaska. It's the tallest peak in North America. And I just thought, okay, you know, and a lot of times I've thought about stuff, but it takes another person to kind of believe in me that before it kind of, you know, the idea gets realized. And I've always been lucky to be surrounded by really great friends who want to be a part of what I do, you know, so I definitely haven't been able to do some of this exciting stuff alone.
So was Mount McKinley the first mountain that you climbed?
Well, I didn't have a ton of experience except rock climbing, you know, and I'd hiked up a lot of like mountains, 14,000-foot peaks in Colorado and stuff, but I knew I had a long way to go, so we went and climbed Long's Peak in Colorado, which is one of the hardest 14,000-foot peaks in January. Got turned back about an hour from the summit. It was freezing cold, high wind. There was a huge windstorm we got caught in. It was like 120 mile-an-hour winds. Totally insane. It was knocking us off our feet. I came down that afternoon, and my eyelids were frozen together, which, you know, didn't matter. You know, blind, but still was kind of weird prying my eyelids apart.
Yeah.
You know, so we tested ourselves a lot, you know, and we went and climbed Mount Rainier in the winter. Never got to the top. We trained like crazy on Mount Humphrey, which is actually a snowy peak in northern Arizona, 12,600-foot peak. And, you know, just did a ton of work with rope travel and crevasse rescue.
You also, but we have a blind spot with Eric Weinmayer. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Phew. Good evening. You're on Blind Spot with Eric Weinmayer.
Good evening, Marlena.
Good evening, Richard.
Very interesting interview tonight, Marlena.
Thank you.
Yeah. I guess the one thing that I guess that you kind of alluded to in the beginning as far as your problem with being able to use your hands, especially in very bad. I understand that with climbing, sometimes you have to actually even pitch yourself in your sleeping bag just in a...
Yeah, figuring out how to sort of survive in the cold where you have big... it's always been an issue for me, you know, and so you're talking about when you have to kind of put your put your sleeping bag inside a crevasse or something?
Right.
Or, you know, there's different things. One, sometimes, yeah, you have to crawl into a, like a deep hole. A glacier is filled with sort of these big cracks. They're called crevasses. It's basically the glacier split, you know, and yeah, sometimes you crawl down into those crevasses to get out of the wind. I've never actually, maybe I've done that once, and I've climbed down crevasses, or lowered down into crevasses plenty of times just for practice and climbed back up. And then also maybe you're talking about ledges. When you're on a rock face, a lot of times you lash yourself into the rock face with a piece of webbing and a piece of metal gear that you jam into a crack, preferably a few of those for a backup.
Yeah, are those, pines? Are those what they call the pines?
Pitons, yeah, but
pines?
We don't really use pitons too much anymore. Yeah. Those are like what they use in the 60s. A lot of times nowadays there's these modern pieces of gear, and they're called Camelots and Friends and Nuts, all sorts of stuff, RPs, I mean, all these different little metal pieces of gear that you can jam into a crack and then you can remove them. Actually, you don't, as a leader. You're climbing up as a leader, and then your team goes behind you. Somebody comes behind you, and they pull the pieces of gear out so that when you get to the top of that pitch, the two people will meet again, and they'll trade off gear, so then the leader will be able to take all that gear up again. So you don't lose stuff. You don't have to leave it in the crack. But yeah, all that I learned to do just through my hands, through feel, you know, to feel the crack and feel the walls of the crack and be able to slam that piece of metal gear in there and feel the teeth biting against the rock and knowing that all the teeth are biting and so forth. You know, a lot of people said, oh, you know, you have to see to do that. And I've always just been able to jam a finger in there and feel for it, make sure it's good. I've never had any problem leaving.
Yeah, I would think that my nephew, he's really into rock climbing and all. So I know it's a feat.
Yeah.
Did you have any other question, Richard?
No. That's I guess the only other thing is if you ever had to get up and get out at night to do things. I mean, were there ever any problems along that
sure,
those
good
ways?
Sure. Well, on a lot of times you don't leave your tent because it's just too dangerous. Like at Camp 3 on Everest, it's just this basically a flat section. Well, there's nothing flat. It's like 45 to 70 degree ice. So when you go up and you basically take your ice axe and the shovel and you chip a flat spot into the ice big enough to set your tent down. So when you leave the tent, you got to make sure your crampons are on. That means these spikes that you wear at the end of your boots. Your boots without those, you'll just slip on the ice and take like a 3,000-foot ride. That's always
good.
Bad. Yeah, so you definitely want to put those crampons on and definitely feel my way. And, you know, you're talking about like when nature calls at night. You have
yeah.
a pee bottle, so you don't have a vestibule and go to the right spot.
Yeah. I know, because on something, a mountain, when you basically take one wrong step and that's...
Yeah.
That's it. You don't.
Exactly.
You
a lot
don't
of times,
wanna...
though, when you leave your tent, you clip into a rope that's anchored in the rock or the ice, and then you clip into that in your harness, and then you kind of hang yourself as far over the cliff as you can, and you go to the bathroom like that.
Yeah. Not pleasant, but you got to do what you got
to
do. I guess the only other question is how did the porters treat you? Because I know I've heard in the beginning, usually there is a lot of porter.
Oh, do you mean the Sherpas?
Yeah.
Yeah, good question. Yeah, the Sherpas, at first, were a little critical, for sure. I mean, our head climbing Sherpa, the Sherpas are the local people there in the Himalayas, he was trying to persuade people to, you know, join our team. And the Sherpas were real reluctant, but he knew that I was a talented, skilled climber. And so he was just keep real persuasive, and he got one of the head Sherpas, one of the real respected Sherpas, to come on, and then the rest kind of followed. But they were still a bit reluctant.
Yeah.
They had heard that it was a whole team of blind people trying to climb Mount Everest, which would definitely change the nature of things. But found out it was just one of me. And it was funny, because then it was the opposite, because on Amitabha, which was our practice climb, we climbed this peak next to Everest the year before as a team. I guess I wasn't flopping on my face, and I wasn't fulfilling those stereotypical roles of a blind person, so the Sherpas started thinking I could see a little bit. Like, maybe I was just coming there and faking and trying to get attention or something.
Because
they said he must be able to see, because he moves so well. Which was a bit of, I guess, a compliment. I'm not really quite sure how to take it, but...
I would consider that a compliment.
Yeah, so, but anyway, I proved to him that I was totally blind. And the women in the marketplaces would take their hands and they'd wave them in front of my face, like just to see if I'd flinch. Of course I would, because I'd feel the wind off their hands, and I'd flinch, and they'd say, look, you can see. So, I don't know, not to gross anyone out, but finally I brought my head, I heard Sherpa into a tent, and I took out one of my glass eyes for him and said, look, pal, take this back to the Sherpa and tell him I'm blind.
And there's another one where that came from, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely. All right. I guess the only other question I have is, how about cooking? How were you able to do any kind of cooking out there as far as...
Yeah, another good system, like setting up the tent, you know. I mean, basically it's just laying the pot on the stove, and it's lighting the stove. I mean, lighting it with a lighter, putting the lighter up to the right spot, listening for the, you know, little blast of over the little fire to make sure, you know, you kind of tell as your hand gets closer to the actual flame, you know.
What is it, like an alcohol type?
No, it's like a propane butane combination. It's like what's in your lighter.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the gas that you bring, and you connect that to your stove in a certain way. I mean, you can kind of hear it hissing. That means that the fuel is flowing and so forth. Yeah, but you know, I just have to be careful and organized and know where everything is and not spill anything, because you don't want to start a fire in your tent. People have had stoves explode on them, and that's blown them right out of their tent down the mountain.
I guess those are the type. Are they still like the Coleman type, where you have to pressurize the
You have to pump
tank.
It like 20 times and get it pressurized and then go for it. And then, you know, it takes forever to boil water at altitude.
Yeah.
It's boiling, but it's still lukewarm. That's just one of the principles of high altitude.
It takes forever to boil water on one of those stoves anyway, no matter where you are, so at altitude. And
it could take you a couple hours to get a boiling pot of water.
Yeah.
And then a lot of times, this has happened from time to time. If you don't, like, air your tent out, all those fumes will just make you pass out.
Yeah, I could bet. Carbon monoxide,
You got to be really careful about that, too. So it took it was a big learning curve, I guess.
Wow, that's a significantly shorter time than the first.
Yeah, we felt so good we skipped right by Camp 1 and went all the way to Camp 2 at 22,000 feet. So.
Now, can you tell us about the different camps and their altitudes and how long you spend at each one?
We don't just climb the mountain straight. You got to kind of shuttle up and down and up and down and up and down, because you're acclimatizing. You're getting your body used to breathing less and less oxygen. You got to kind of have to convince your body to do that. You know, if you just landed at the top of Mount Everest, somehow, if you were able to do that, you'd pass out, you'd be dead within like 30 seconds. So you have to kind of slowly work your body into breathing. Basically comes down to like a third or a fourth of the oxygen that you have at sea level. And then you're also shuttling loads up to carry stuff, you know, get stuff up to the higher camps so you can stock them and set your tents up and everything. And the Sherpas do help you quite a bit with that. You know, they bring a lot of the loads up there. They're super strong, but still, I mean, pride makes you as a Westerner try to carry your share.
Yeah, and let me stop you right here. We do have a call.
Okay.
Good evening. You are on Blind Spot. Hello, you're on Blind Spot.
Hi, Marlena. It's Cindy.
Ah, there she is. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Cindy.
Meet Eric.
Hi. Eric. I lost VHCB radio on my computer, and I don't know what happened. But anyway, I hope you didn't answer this question already. I wanted to find out how much stuff you actually have to carry when you're going up. I mean, how much do you have to carry yourself?
Well, you really, as a Westerner, you really only have to carry your own personal gear. You know, your sleeping bags, you usually have two sleeping bags, one that you leave at base camp and one that you bring higher up the mountain. So your own oxygen, your own sleeping bag and Therm-a-Rest and air mattress. It's called a Z-Rest and Therm-a-Rest. It's just like air mattress and then a big foam pad.
Mm-hmm.
Your fuel, your stove, some of your personal food. Doesn't seem like a lot, but it actually does add up to about 40 or so pounds.
Oh, my God.
And that's a lot on your back at, like, 26,000 feet.
That's a lot on my back at sea level, Eric.
I agree. Oh,
but the
my.
Sherpas are carry way bigger loads than Westerners. I mean, I was, especially through the icefall, I tried to go light every time because I was worried about speed. The Sherpas carry these, like, 60-pound loads through the icefall. They're little tiny guys, but they're so strong. I mean, I think it's just maybe they know how to suffer. I honestly think, I don't think there's like a big genetic difference between us and them. I just think that they're, from the time they're born to just like go to the market or to go anywhere, they're walking up these big hills, you know, and they just know how to suffer and suck it up. And I think as Westerners, we've lost the ability to really suffer. I mean, the Sherpas die much more than Westerners.
I know
they take more risks and so forth. And
I mean,
they push themselves maybe too hard sometimes, so.
I know you prepare a lot for this, but don't you get awfully cold by the time you're finished?
Yeah, you're cold. You're looking for beaches and Hawaii for sure. But yeah, you do get cold. But mountains aren't just cold; they're extreme. You know, so they're hot in the day, and they're cold at night. So, say at base camp, or going through the icefall in the middle of the day with the sun just beating down on you and reflecting off the snow, it's like an oven. It intensifies that sun, and it's all white, you know. So it's like one of those big reflected blankets that you use in case of an emergency.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's bouncing and absorbing and bouncing back up at you. So I mean, you have sunburns everywhere in the nostrils, on your tongue. Some people's tongues swell up and split. It's been registered when we were going through the icefall, and through the Western Coombe, which is right above the icefall, at 110 degrees on the glacier surface. So you're wearing a Gore-Tex, and you just whip it all off because you're just dying of heat. And then 5 minutes later, a cloud comes over and it starts snowing, and then you're shivering, and it's like 0 degrees. And so you put your Gore-Tex back on, and then the cloud leaves, and it gets hot again. You take your Gore-Tex off, and you do that like 20 times a day.
Wow.
Okay, any other questions, Cindy?
No, I think that's all. This is really interesting. Thank you.
All right, well, we've got another call, so I'll move on to them, and I'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Cindy. Hello, you're on Blind Spot.
Hello, is that me?
That's you.
Ah, this is Lois. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Lois.
Hi. Hey, this is a very interesting program, and Eric, my question for you, I've been in sub-zero temperatures at times, and I've been around some fairly deep snow. I'm wondering, did you notice and did it bother you at all that sound acts differently at those temperatures and in all that ice and snow, that somehow, I don't know whether that absorbs it or whether it all bounces away?
Yeah, very good. I think it depends on the consistency of the snow and deep, kind of thick, powdery snow.
Mm.
It's sort of like being in a soundproof room.
Mm-hmm.
Some sort of muffled sound. It takes the sound and it kind of absorbs it.
Yeah, everything's dead.
Yeah. On the ice, it bounces off. So that's, it's just different in all different occasions.
Okay, so it has to do with density, probably.
It does. Mm-hmm. I think it does have to do with density, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, yeah, because on real hard ice, it's totally different from that soft snow, that muffled sound of soft snow.
Mm-hmm, which might absorb some more absorption if it was looser, too.
Exactly right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I didn't notice not being able to hear, as well or anything up higher or in colder temperatures. I didn't notice that, but that could be true. I just never noticed it.
Then it would be an acoustical difference, not necessarily bother your sense of direction.
Right. No, I've never had that. I do like to hear really well when I'm up there, so one of my issues is,
really?
I don't like to wear a hat if I don't have to, so
right.
Even on summit day, I never put my down hood on or anything. I did wear a balaclava, which is like a fleece mask that goes over your face, but it covers your ears, but it's pretty thin, you know, because I like my ears to be able to hear. And so, yeah, sometimes when I have to whip that huge down hood over my over myself, I'm definitely at a loss. And it has to get pretty darn cold for me to do that. I'd rather my ears be cold, but you got to be careful with that, too, because you don't want to frostbite your ear.
That's what I was thinking as you spoke, because I know when I was in cold parts of the country, I didn't like the heavy hoods either because of that.
Yeah, but you
same
have
thing
to
in the water.
But I mean, it really does have to get amazingly cold for me to start doing that. And it's not really even cold. It's more wind. It starts blowing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Also, I suppose, I just heard your comments about the sun and the reflection. I suppose you couldn't wear any sun protector because it would freeze.
No, you can. There's certain kinds of sun protection that doesn't freeze. It just kind of... And actually, it does freeze a little bit, but you just kind of keep it warm against your body, and you're definitely putting tons of sunscreen on all the time. Some people even use that zinc oxide, but I never did.
Very interesting. Well, I guess that's all, and thank you for being here tonight. Very interesting program, and thanks to you and Marlena and Jonathan.
Well, thanks for calling, Lois. Well, I appreciate it.
Very good. I'll talk to you again.
I hope so. Have a good night.
You too.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And the telephone number is area code 212-812-2800 with a PIN of 0480551. So how many base camps or how many camps are there to climbing Mount Everest?
We have a base camp at 17,800 feet, and then you go through the icefall, and above the icefall at about 20,000 feet is Camp 1. And then you have your big camp. Yeah, they call it Camp 2 or Advanced Base Camp at about 22,000 feet. It's on some rocks above the Western Coombe. And out of the avalanche danger. And then from there, it's like maybe a 1,000-foot slope up. And then that's the start of the Lhotse face, which is like this 45 to 70-degree, very icy section. Big ice, steep wall. It was one of the cruxes when, Hillary and those guys climbed it in 53. Getting up the Lhotse face was a big deal. Now it's still a pretty big deal because there's ice fall and rock fall zipping by your head, so you have to be super careful and wear a helmet. And at the middle of that, about 24,000 feet, is Camp 3, just chipped right out of the ice. Then you go up another 1,000 feet and traverse left and go through something called the Yellow Band and then traverse more and then up through something called the Geneva Spur. And when you pop up above the Geneva Spur, it's a real steep rock face, you're at 8,000 meters. That's 26,000 feet. That's called the Death Zone, which is really...
That's appetizing.
Yeah.
I can't wait to go there.
Where your body sort of... begins to break down and your brain stops functioning well and your body begins to kind of eat itself because nothing assimilates, you know, no nutrition or anything. So it's just a matter of time before you're going to be in trouble up there. So you try to, at that point, stay in that section of the mountain as little time as possible. So you establish your Camp 4 at 26,000 feet. That's called the South Col. It's like a notch between Everest and Lhotse, which is the fourth highest peak in the world. And it's super windy in there, and you're on oxygen at that point. You have a big oxygen mask and a bottle that you're carrying in a pack. And you have about, one every maybe 8 hours if you're careful. Less when you're sleeping, but use more oxygen when you're active. And we waited up there about 24 hours and hydrated up, got a lot of fluids in us. You're not too hungry. It's more like soups and stuff that you eat. And we left about 9 at night for the summit on May 24th. And it's so windy at the South Col that I couldn't hear those bells anymore. Chris Morris, my teammate, had to hike in front of me and bang rocks with his ice axe so I could hear him to follow. And did that through the wind for about 2 hours. And then popped into this gully that takes you up the mountain. It's real steep rock and snow at that point. And you're just kind of cruising up, just trying to stay balanced, trying to stay clear-headed because you have a tendency of sort of feeling like you're going to suffocate, and also that your mind just isn't working. It's very hard to concentrate and focus. It feels like you're perceiving reality like through a straw, just a long straw. Somebody will tell you to do something and it takes like a few seconds for your brain to process it and go, okay, he wants me to clip into this rope. you know, just it takes a while to process. And we, about 2 in the morning, made it to the balcony, which is about halfway to the summit. And at that point, obviously, as you do on upper mountains, we went into the face of this just horrendous storm with lightning crashing all around us, and super cold and white-out conditions where nobody who could see could see. And the snow was blowing sideways. I mean, it was nasty. We're all in these one-piece down suits, and we kind of hunkered down together. We were really thinking we were going to turn back, you know, because that's what you do in the face of a storm like that. You don't go on. That's totally just suicide, you know. And we were there for maybe 40 minutes kind of debating, what should we do? Should we go forward? Should we turn back? And we were about, you know, we're moments away from turning back when somebody from our base camp manager called up and said, hey, it's clearing up down here. And at Camp 2, they said, hey, it's clearing up here too. And then a climber looked up, you know, because we were starting to try to monitor the storm, looked up and said, I can see a star through the clouds. So we thought, well, maybe it is actually improving. That's a miracle, but maybe it is. And we push forward a few more minutes, and it actually did clear up. And about 4 in the morning, the sun comes up, or maybe even before that, because, you know, there's nothing to block it on Earth. When the sun comes up, you're probably the first on Earth to see the sunrise or to feel it. And so we made it to the south summit, which is at 28,800 feet. And at that point, you still have like 2 hours, because you have to climb down from the south summit, and you have to cross what's called the knife edge, which is this ridge. It's maybe 2 feet wide, or some places it's maybe the width of your boot. And there's a 12,000 foot drop on the right in Tibet, and an 8,000 foot drop into Nepal on the left, and you just have to be very super careful. I'm using my ski poles at this point, scanning for the, you know, those boot marks that people have been kicking in the ice, so they're kind of frozen boot marks. And you can feel your foot lock into those boot marks, so you know whether it's a good step or not. And friends were, I know, looking back at me, lifting their oxygen masks and calling out directions if they had to. And it's real slow, you know. The guy, one of the guys on our team, had summited in 96. And that was his second time on the mountain. When he climbed with us, it was actually his third time. And he said the difference between the first time and the second time was, the first time he was taking 12 breaths between each step, and the second time he got it down to 6 breaths between each step. So it's super slow. You feel like you're in slow motion. So it's, you know, step, breathe, 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 step. And it's just super slow, and you're just trying to stay focused and not do anything stupid.
Okay, we have a couple of calls, and let's get them on. Hello, you're on Blind Spot.
Hello, good evening, Marlena and Eric.
Hi.
Hello, Dave.
Hello, I'm Dave Williams. I'm calling in from the UK, where it's quarter to 4 in the morning. I'd like to congratulate you, of course, first of all, on your achievement. And don't stop. You were just about to get to the summit, and I'm sitting here on the end of the phone. The adrenaline was going, and then she goes, oh, and then we'll go to a call. I can't believe it. It's like those programs where we say, tune in next week to see what happens.
But remember, Dave, it's a slow process to get to the summit.
Well, absolutely. I was loving it every minute. Absolutely. Carry on, Eric. Don't let me stop. Tell about that, and then I'll go ahead with my questions.
So you cruise along this thing for about 100 yards.
Sorry, can I just interrupt? You were just saying before you got to the South Summit that the difficulty in sort of processing information, I think the phrase you used was perceiving reality through a straw. Is that because of the lack of oxygen up there?
It is, yeah. Basically up there you have a third of the oxygen, but it feels like even less because there's such little air pressure. It's, you know, that the oxygen you're breathing, it's very it's spread out, I guess, somehow. So you're not getting, not only is there only a third of the oxygen in the air, but you're just not getting enough of it because it's not condensed, you know.
Right. So you feel after exerting yourself for a short period, then you would feel more lethargic than you would at sea level.
Completely.
Presumably.
Yeah. In fact, it's just hard. Like, it's hard moving in general.
Right.
You know, you have to go so slow, like packing up your sleeping bag is just like this horrendously huge process. Everything's difficult up there. And a lot of times what people do is they get so lethargic up there that they just sit down in the snow and they say, I'll rest a little while, and they don't get up. So that's what happens. Our rule is...
Isn't that can be dangerous, I understand, that if you get like that...
If you get like that, you you know, it's good to be around good team members because they hopefully can get you down. But it's pretty hard to get people down from that altitude because you're kind of barely hanging on yourself. And honestly, if somebody was in trouble, you might have a little difficulty putting them on your back or anything. I mean, you could probably talk them down. A whole group of people working together could probably get somebody, despondent down. But you'd have a heck of a time, and that's so you definitely are sort of responsible for yourself. But one of the things we were proud of as a team was that we were a real team. I mean, nobody was being paid. We were just good friends who had been climbing together for years, and we were taking care of each other. I remember a teammate on our team saw somebody near the summit who was just laying in the snow, one of our teammates, and that's a bad thing. And he was super tired, and he said, "I just need some water to make it to the summit." And Eric Alexander took out his last half quart of water, gave it to him, he drank it down, and made it to the summit. So people were really cool towards each other.
But so anyway, you're on this knife edge. Well, I mean, how many of you are there at this point?
Well, that'll leave for a surprise till the end, but because that's not a cool part of the story. But
We climbed the
Hillary Step, which we had talked about earlier, and that's maybe this like 50-foot rock face, a technical rock face. Only about 20 feet of it's real vertical and hard, but and I was in my element at that point because I'm able to feel the rock with my hands now. So it's really cool climbing a rock face at 29,000 feet. And you belly flop your way over that. There's a big rock. You're basically like on a ledge now. And it's just, I mean, you can hear just the earth dropping away. It's just this amazing sound of space. It's kind of beautiful but pretty terrifying, you know. And traversed from there, it's just like the ridge expands a little bit, so it's not quite knife edge, but it's more of a rounded ridge, but it's still only about 10 feet wide. And you just, at that point, it's not as steep, and you just traverse your way up. And it was about, I don't know, 2 minutes from the summit that my friend Chris Morris turned to me, and he totally lost his voice because everyone loses their voice up there because you cough real bad, and people with broken ribs just coughing. So he didn't have much of a voice, but in this big Alaskan garbled voice, he turned to me and said, "My friends call me Big E." He said, "Big E," he said, "we're about to stand on top of the world."
Oh.
And it was about another 2 minutes, took a step, and there wasn't anywhere else to go.
I just want to know how you felt when you knew that you finally got there. What did you feel?
Well, it's conflicting emotions because, in a sense, a part of your mind is just focused like it's a job, you know? I mean, you're working so hard to get there. You really don't have the luxury of like, wow, this is beautiful, you know? It's not like you're thinking about world peace or, you know, the love between the nations. You're really just thinking about surviving and being safe.
You figure, how the hell am I going to get down from here, presumably?
Thinking about how I'm going to get down, thinking I'm only halfway there, I have a long way down, thinking about all this stuff. So you're just like, it's like when you're running a marathon, you know, you're halfway through, you know? You're not really thinking about the finish line yet. But you do have a moment of reflection, and see, I was thinking about it like that because I just was nervous, and I have a 14-month-old daughter, and I just wanted to be very, very safe and careful. And so my friend Jeff Evans, though, he stopped me and he said, "Hey, Biggie," he said, "I know we're worried because there's a huge storm coming in up from the north, just big dark clouds, as my friends described it, rolling in on us, and that's pretty bad up at that altitude." And he said, "You know, I know we're nervous about getting down," he said, "take a moment and think about where you are. You'll never be here again." He said, "Think about, you know," he said, actually his words were, "look around," that's a good friend to me because he's not scared to use words. He said, "Look around and think about where you are and what you've done."
This was towards the end of May. And can you give us a sense of what time of day, like local time?
In the morning. You want to be, that's why you start so early, you know, at 9 at night, because you want to summit in the morning, because every afternoon on Everest it snows and it whites out. The key is to be down by the afternoon.
I need to jump in here for a second, and we've got two more calls and almost no time. Can we go a little longer, Jonathan? Is that possible? Ah, He said, is that all right with you, Eric?
Sure.
Ah, the men in my life agree. What do you know?
That's fantastic. I could hear those calls coming in, and I thought, I'm never going to get a chance to ask my questions. Well, of course I wanted to know how it felt, and you've just described that. Presumably when you got home, what did you do? You know, I mean, what does a guy do who's just climbed mountains? I mean, I'm blind as well, and I admire anybody who's climbed Everest, you know, and I'm not really kind of gushing about the blind thing so much, although I know, you know, a lot of people are, and obviously it's a huge achievement, and, you know, I know blind climbers, and if you've got that, well, I've got to get on with it type attitude, then you don't even think about it as being significant, I don't suppose, in a huge way, but anybody who's got to, you know, McKinley's one thing, but, I mean, Everest. Stroll on. What did you do when you got? I mean, did you just go in and watch the telly?
You don't really quite know what to do. In fact, you can't even. You know, you don't even know. You work so hard your whole life. I'd focus so much on getting to the top of this mountain that once you're there, you're like, well, what do I do? You know, it's just you come home and there was a huge media storm. You're met with like 50 cameras in the airport, and you know, and life has been totally like a zoo. You know, tons of opportunities, everyone's talking about this and that. I mean, I just climbed the mountain because I like to climb, but
yeah.
Didn't realize that my life was going to completely change when I got home. Or not completely change, but the periphery of my life would change. But that I love that now. It's just like I love to sit in the grass in the park with my daughter and my wife and just be, you know, sliding down the slides and playing in the sand with her and smelling the flowers and just being warm through your whole body. It's just a wonderful thing to just be able to have have just peace, you know. And you're not scared. It's a difference between on Everest. Everything is intense, you know. Everything is intense, even the boredom. And at home, it's just it's different.
And just my final question, and I will go and let these other people speak to you. The media attention. I mean. How have you found that? To what extent, you know, have you? I'm not really sure what the question is. I'm trying to ask.
Yeah.
Really, how have you dealt? I mean, presumably it was weird because obviously it's something that you probably hadn't experienced before.
No, I hadn't experienced it to this degree. I think I take myself out of the equation. I mean, in terms of my ego, I could care less about media attention, but. Maybe for blindness, maybe it's a good thing. I know the National Federation of the Blind sponsored the climb because they wanted to kind of take people's perceptions about blindness and kind of shatter them. And I think that's good. Sighted world, I think, you know, they don't know what to think. You know, some people just think, well, wow, that's really cool. It kind of expands my own possibilities. Some people don't know what to think. There are those kind of losers of the world that still think somehow I cheated or I got dragged up on a rope. In fact, there's some kind of colonel or something in the UK that actually
there is?
Yeah, wrote in the newspaper there. And what is the newspaper in London?
Well, you might be talking about the Times, maybe.
Yeah, the London Times.
Fairly kind of right-wing.
He said the blind guy did take it to the top, but, you know, he had to have 20 seeing eye guides to do it, you know, and just trying to undermine the whole thing. People have done that here, too, in the U.S., and you know, so it's just...
But, yeah, I mean, surely, I mean, you were there. I mean, the point being that, obviously, you know, they weren't there and you were there. You know what happened.
My friends go on and try to write responses and get all belligerent and stuff because they say,
yeah.
Exactly.
It's not even worth speaking to that level. It really isn't.
But
really isn't even worth...
The point is, I guess, some people just don't know how to react. They don't know what to think. You know, they can't put the two things together, a blind person and Mount Everest. It just doesn't fit in their brains. And maybe that's the point, you know. Maybe it's good.
Okay.
I'm going to go. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, Eric, and good luck whatever you decide to do with your future. And thanks for the opportunity to speak to you. And I'll speak to you soon, Marlena.
Thanks, Dave.
All the best.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
And let's push the button again, Jonathan, and bring on the next call. Hello, you're on Blind Spot.
Well, hello, Marlena. This is Charles in Sacramento.
Hi, Charles.
You know, Charles and Venus.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to say hello to Eric.
Hi.
It's a great pleasure. I haven't read your book yet. I requested it from the library. But we all know how the talking library is. Probably everybody else is reading it. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And When you came to Sacramento, I wasn't in town. In fact, for amateur radio operators like Marlena, I was out on field day.
Uh-huh.
And so I didn't get to hear you speak, but somebody from the Sacramento Society did, and he would tell me about it. And I told him, boy, I wish I could get a tape of it. And he thought it was real good. So what he mentioned, in fact, it started making me read the book. What he had mentioned is that you were talking about, and I know what he's referring to, that on the way up there, well, back in 1996, there's a book called Into Thin Air.
Right, Jonathan Krakauer, Into Thin Air.
Yeah.
Oh, you're up on it there, Maya.
I'm an Everest person.
Yes, well, we've become Everest people, too. And he was telling me that he said you guys had walked by some of the bodies that were up there.
Yeah, there's a lot of bodies up there above 26,000 feet. There's bodies all the way to the summit. There's maybe four or five of them. And nobody really has the energy or the ability or the will to drag those bodies down. In fact, when they're Sherpas, the Sherpas are superstitious, and they're not allowed to touch anyone who's dead because sort of that bad luck rubs off on them somehow. So, yeah, you're passing bodies, and I couldn't see them. I was glad of that because they're pretty gross-looking, I'm sure. They're mummified and so forth. They're laying in the snow. There was an Austrian who fell from the top of the southeast ridge when the day before us and died. So, yeah, you just have to push on for sure. It's a little bit of a downer.
Did you have any other questions, Charles? Oh, he's gone. Okay. Then let's take the next call. Hello, you're on Blind Spot. Hello, you're on Blind Spot.
Hi, Marlena. Hello,
Hi,
Eric.
Sue.
My name is Sue. I'm from Seattle.
Hi.
I lost my computer connection for about 15 minutes, so I'm curious where you live.
I live in Colorado.
Colorado, okay.
Yeah, I live near Denver.
Cool.
So I got the Rocky Mountains right up in my backyard.
That must be why you got into this. Would you do this?
Yeah, for sure.
If you had the chance, would you do it again?
I won't do it again, but if I could start over and do it again, yeah, I would do it again, but I wouldn't do it a second time.
Would your wife let you do it again?
No, I always tease my wife and say, hey, when my daughter grows up, we'll be the first father-daughter team to summit Mount Everest. By the way, I didn't mention that to that last caller that he wanted to know how many people that were on our team. We had 13 Westerners and 8 Sherpas, and we had 19 people to the summit that day, which was a world record.
Wow.
And we had the first first father-son team, or American father-son team, Sherm Bull and his son, Brad Bull. Sherm Bull is the oldest man in the world, 64 years old.
Yeah, we heard that was very cool.
Maybe people told me I'm the blindest man in the world. So that was a world record.
At least the blindest man to be on Mount Everest.
Sure. Anyway, so yeah, we had a bunch of world records that day that we set, which was pretty cool.
If I'm being repetitive, Marlena, stop me, but when you got to the top, how were you able to, and how soon were you able to communicate that fact to the outer world?
We radioed down, each were carrying radios that day, just in case you get in trouble. And I radioed down and said, I can't believe it. We're on the top.
One thing that I want to share, if I can just jump in for a minute, Sue, before your next question. When on summit day for you, Eric, I happened to have the opportunity to fill in on very short notice over on our interactive side here on ACB Radio, which is where we do music shows. And one of our DJs was not able to be there, had a computer failure, posted a message into our staff list and said, can somebody help? I said, yes, I can. 5 minutes later, I was on the air. And I have been looking at the Everest 2001 website pretty much all day. And I have to tell you that while you were very close to the summit and we were getting the reports back through the Internet, the ACB listening audience was just, the MSN messages and email I was getting were phenomenal, and people would say, well, write him and tell him that we're with him and tell him that we care. And And we really prayed you up that summit. Let me
tell you this.
I know he had his laptop with him.
But when we were at the summit, I honestly did not feel like I was just standing there with my team. I felt like I was like it was a crowded summit because we had so many people following along, emailing us and praying for our success and our safe return. I felt like I was standing on the shoulders of a lot of people, blind and sighted, all over the world.
You certainly were. And when I read that you summited, it was quite late here that night. And my husband is well noted for going to bed early. And I read that you summited, and I'm a very emotional person. Anyone who knows me knows that, right, Sue?
Yes.
And I went running into our bedroom, and I woke my husband up, and I said, we've done it. Shattered it. He did it. And, of course, the tears were just rolling down my face. So, anyway, Sue, to your next question.
Very nice.
Well, I just want to say when I was listening to your story, it is emotional. I sure wish I'd been following the summit. I guess I'd intended to, but didn't. But anyway, you should be proud of what you did. Whether you're blind or sighted doesn't matter. I don't know why the hell anybody'd want to do it. Excuse me, it sounds horrible to me. But then, you know, my idea of roughing it is the Holiday Inn. So what can I say?
Thank you.
Anyway, there's probably other people. Great show, Marlena, and congratulations, Eric. You should be real proud of yourself, and I bet your wife thinks you're the best guy in the world. And your daughter will be very proud of you when she grows up and hears about her dad.
Very good.
So, good night, Marlena.
Good night, Eric.
Bye-bye.
Okay, let's bring in another call. Good evening. You're on Blind Spot.
Hi, Marlena. It's Buddy in Dallas.
Hi, Buddy in Dallas.
Hi.
Meet Eric in Colorado.
Hello, Eric.
Thanks.
Hey, listen. Well, first of all, I want to say I'm enjoying the interview, even with the brief outages. And I'm going to turn these speakers off so I don't have to listen to myself. Shut up. Thank you. First of all, of course, I just want to say that you know I was following the climb with a lot of interest too, and congratulations for making it up there. I guess kind of off of what a couple of callers ago were asking, how do you respond to people who pretty much say that not so much that you cheated, but that, you know, the whole mountain climbing Everest is just an exploitative of the native people, and Westerners shouldn't be up there throwing all their crap around and all that.
Good question. Very good question. I hear a lot of climbers, a lot of experts, so-called experts on Mount Everest, talk about how mountain climbing has changed. It's not as pure anymore. It's commercial. In a sense, they're right. I don't think climbing a mountain should be like a conquest. It shouldn't be like something you put on your resume as something, you know, to help you get something. I agree with them in that sense. But in a sense, I think we have to understand that the world has changed, the access especially. And, now the average affluent person, if they really save up money, can have the means to climb Mount Everest. A guided trip, I think, is $65,000 or $70,000. Before, it took the resources of a nation to get a team to Everest. Now, it's just like any rich guy can go up there, technically.
Right.
For us, we were an unguided trip, so our costs were much lower than that. But I went out and got sponsorship and so forth. In terms of, the access, I mean, it's just that's the way the world is. But it doesn't take 3 months just to get to base camp anymore. You can fly into 9,000 feet, and you can be to base camp in 10 days. And you can't go back in time. I mean, so the other thing with the people, they're Sherpas are the richest people in Nepal now. Since the 50s, or even since the 20s, the Sherpas have been making a living through climbing. Before, they were subsistence farmers. They were, starving to death. Eating a few yams and stuff. Now, they're, as I said, the richest people in Nepal. they get tremendous pride from climbing Mount Everest and the mountains around there. Being a climbing Sherpa is like being a professional baseball player here. You are the cream of the crop. Everyone respects you. And before there was a caste system, if you were a poor farmer, you'd stay a poor farmer. Now, on your talent of climbing, you can rise from the poorest person in the poorest caste to being the richest person in town. And so I honestly think that climbing has done a lot for that country, for the Khumbu, and it's mostly been positive. Obviously, there are environmental problems. There's so many tourists now that, you know, they use a lot of wood to use on fires, and that they're cutting down a lot of their forests. That's a big problem. There's a Hillary Foundation that's trying to regrow forests in that area to kind of stop that problem. Definitely overpopulation now is a bit of a problem. But in all, I think it's good for the people. And also, they're one of the few people. Some people make a lot of money and they grow away from their religion. The Sherpas have been one of the few religions, or few people, that money has helped them establish their religion even more, because a lot of the Sherpas put their money towards Buddhist temples and schools and things like that. So actually, Buddhism has become more entrenched rather than sort of losing sight. So I just think some of those people are a little bit too cynical. The other thing that a lot of them say is, you know, now anybody can climb Mount Everest, even if you don't have the skill, on a guided trip. And I think that's, in a sense, a little bit true. But most people you meet up there are pretty experienced climbers. There are some disasters. There are some things that happen. But I don't think guided people make more mistakes than an experienced climber. In fact, some of the most experienced climbers in the world, a lot of them, in fact, die in the mountains. And they have all the experience in the world. I don't want to be in a position to start thinking about, you know, who belongs on a mountain and who doesn't. That's a job for whatever god you pray to. It's not a job for humans to start deciding that. There were a lot of people who thought me, you know, just saw me being blind and said, he has no business on that mountain. He's going to be a huge liability. He's going to kill himself. He's going to kill his team. John Krakauer, actually, of Into Thin Air, wrote me a really nice letter and tried to persuade me not to go. He said it was a big mistake. It's a different world up there. You shouldn't go. So, you know, I don't know who these people are who are qualified to decide who can go and who can't.
So did he write you again afterwards?
No.
Yeah.
So, thanks, and
sure.
Again, congratulations on getting up there. No, I think.
Thanks, and that's a very good question, though.
I agree. But I think that I think that if you're going to climb up there, if you're not experienced, you're probably not going to make it up to the top unless a helicopter drops you up there or something.
And a helicopter can't possibly do that.
No.
Right.
No.
Well, thanks, buddy.
Certainly.
Okay. Have a good night.
You too. Good night, y'all.
Night. One of the we can probably begin to wrap it up now. I think the board is clear, but one of the speaking of John Krakauer, one of the people whom I have met in person who has climbed Everest was Beck Weathers.
Sure. Didn't actually climb, but didn't make it to the top.
Extended.
Whoops, our conference is being extended. That's right. He'd not make it to the top. That's right.
You got to make it down with all your fingers and toes.
That's true. That's true. Some, you know, so somehow when you work so hard to get up there, you think, well, that climbing mountain, if you're a person with no experience, you think, well, gosh, he climbed. I guess more appropriately, I could say he was on Everest.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And his book Left for Dead is just an amazing
awesome
book, and it totally has changed his life, both physically, obviously, because of the physical disabilities he now has, but more importantly, and he admitted this very candidly, it changed his life spiritually.
Sure.
And my last question to you is, how has it changed your life?
Well, you appreciate things more. I appreciate, just home life. You know, home life is a big adventure in itself. And one of the things that I'm focused on these days is, I just don't want to be good at the real big, worldwide, important things. I want to be good at the small things, too. I want to be good at being a dad. I want to be good at, like, feeding my daughter and playing with her and giving her baths and changing her diapers. I want to be good at those little things, too. I just don't want to be known as the blind guy who climbed Everest, because my wife tells me something, has told me something that I think is so brilliant, is that, you know, you're not going to be known for what you've done, but how you connected with people and how much you love people. So I think that's to be kept in mind.
Absolutely. Eric, this has been probably the most fascinating blind spot that I have had the privilege to present, and I appreciate so much your taking the time. I know your schedule is crazy.
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on behalf of ACB Radio and all of the listeners, thank you for joining us, and probably most importantly, though, thank you for helping all of us to be able to walk a little more proudly and say, see, we told you blindness doesn't have to stop you. Look what that guy did.
Very good.
Thanks, Eric.
Thanks.
And don't forget to join me next week for Blind Spot on ACB Radio Mainstream. And what we will be talking about is a surprise, because I don't know. I'm Marlena Lieberg. Thanks for listening to this very special Blind Spot. If you'd like to get a hold of me, my email address is Marlena, that's M-A-R-L-A-I-N-A, at acbradio.org. Have a great week, and thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Blind Spot on ACB Radio. Thanks to our technical people, Chris Bell, for making the music happen, and Jonathan Mosen for making the program possible. If you have any ideas for something you might like to hear on Blind Spot, drop me an email. It's Marlena, M-A-R-L-A-I-N-A, at acbradio.org.